Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give, and there is no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off, and every now and then, or once every time you listen, it's really up to you. Click on the supporter link in the episode description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your contribution.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Steve Lawler, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hi there, everyone. It's me, Matt Rouse, the managing editor at House Culture and the host of the House Culture Podcast. Welcome back for those that are already in the know, and a big shout out to our new listeners. Where have you been all this time? I also want everybody to brace themselves because we're taking the show to the next level in what is our fifth season. It's not just your eardrums in for a treat. Now you can catch all of the action on our YouTube channel. And yeah, apologies in advance for my perpetual fanboy face. It's all part of the fun. If you are new to House Culture and the podcast, buckle up for an incredible journey ahead of yourself, as we've already hosted dance music titans like Paul Oakenfold, Fatboy Slim, Todd Terry, Roger Sanchez, David Morales and Danny Tenaglia. They're all there in our back catalogue, so get digging through that crate. As I mentioned, we are live across the visual realm as well as the audio, so please do us a solid and subscribe to our YouTube channel. You can also join the party on our home on Instagram at HouseCultureNet. We've got over 300,000 party people following us already, and you are missing out if you're not part of the crew. Check the links in the episode description to secure your spot on that precious guest list and stay informed of everything that we do across House Culture. We're so excited about this new season as we have an absolute stellar selection of names on the lineup. You will not be disappointed. In terms of a headliner, there could be only one choice. The king of the space terrace himself, Steve Lawler. In our chat, you'll hear how seriously Steve took his breakout role as a Cafe Mambo resident in Ibiza.
My Mambo set, which would be 8 hours, I took the responsibility really seriously. Like, it was my job to enhance everybody's time. I've said this before, it's like performing a soundtrack. But I'd have 4 boxes of records. They were my tools. And I had to know those records inside out to do that.
The impact that his legendary Space Terrace sets had on his career.
Playing on the Space Terrace was the best gigs in my life. And it turned into something magical, and the Space Terrace residency was the point in my career. Things were going really well, but then I became a big time headliner, like overnight.
The power he wields when being a resident DJ.
I've always preferred being a resident DJ than I have being a headliner. You know, to me, there's more about being a DJ than just rocking up somewhere and playing for 90 minutes. But the most important thing to me is that I get to create and do what I want to do. That is first and foremost. And so having a residency, you get to do that. You get to carve out your own thing.
And how his new Pendulum project has allowed him to stay true to his DJ ideals.
DJing is being the curator of music for a night and giving people an experience. So I'm just doing my own path. And the reason why Pendulum has grown now is because it's authentic. I'm just doing what I love. You know, it's just an amazing atmosphere of people just getting down, partying. And that's what Warriors was. That's what Harlem Nights was. It's what We Love was. It's what Deep South was. It's kind of the same thing. I'm just obviously just being me.
Let's kick this season off, shall we? This is Steve Lawler.
House Culture.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for sitting down with us on this launch episode of season 5 of the House Culture podcast. It's an honour to have your name as the headliner for this. You've gone by many different guises over the years, whether that is DJ SL in that early era, through to the King of the Space Terrace, the director of Deep South, the host of Harlem Nights, and now the pioneer of your new Pendulum project. However, we obviously want to chat about all of that, but before we start, let's go back to your growing up in Birmingham and how you first discovered music there that you loved and enjoyed.
Well, I mean, I tell you how it really started was just growing up as early teens, 13, mm-hmm. 14. I was always a fan. I was a fan of more electronic based music. And I also really liked The Doors. And it's only later in my life that I realized that I was quite clearly attracted to synthesizers, you know, electronic music, mm-hmm. which these guys were all using and pioneering, you know, Joy Division, Depeche Mode, The Doors, like I say, you know, all their music was filled with organs and sound effects. And even though they were a rock band, that was quite a big part of their music. So I didn't really, I was too young to analyze music or even understand it. Mm-hmm. I just followed what I liked. And in the late 80s, sort of 89, I don't even know, well, I do, there were some older friends that lived in the same city that I lived in. Mm-hmm. And on one occasion, I tried to go to a nightclub. I think I was 15 or 16 at the time. And I got turned away at the door because I looked too young. Mm-hmm. And all my friends got in. And that devastated me. You know, like I was the uncoolest kid in school at that point. It devastated me. And on another occasion, when I was in the town I grew up in, a whole bunch of us were out, and people were going to a nightclub in Birmingham, mm-hmm. at a night called the Snapper Club, mm-hmm. at the Hummingbird. Mm-hmm. And I just said, look, I'm not doing it. I won't get in. And they said to me, and I remember this vividly, I talk about this in my documentary. Mm. They said, don't worry, they're not going to check your age. They'll search you for weapons and drugs. But they don't care about how old you are. It's that kind of place.
Yeah.
So I was like, great, I'll get in. Little did I realize it was this acid house haven. And I just experienced this sound that I didn't even know existed.
Yeah.
And from that moment, it wasn't just the sound, actually. And this, I think, this is kind of what's gone throughout my whole career. I had an experience, mm-hmm. and it was a combination of the sound, of the lights, of the room full of people on drugs. It just kind of had this atmosphere that I was just completely blown away by.
Yeah.
It was like I left the world and went to something otherworldly. And it hit me so much that straight after I started asking, where can I find this music? And
yeah.
I was told about a pirate radio station called PCRL, mm-hmm. in Birmingham at the time, which I used to listen to. And that used to tell you about a record store called Don Christie's, mm-hmm. which was primarily a black music store selling reggae and R&B. But downstairs they had, in the basement, acid house.
Yeah.
So I started buying this music, mm-hmm. and I was just kind of hooked.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
that really the beginning of it. And from that moment on, it was in my life every week.
And I mean, were you one of these people turning up to the record shop and being like, I've heard this tune, it goes like bom 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 or something like that, and they're like, what the fuck are you talking about? Or were you like over looking at the labels on the record decks, being a bit of a train spotter and, you know, taking that in and then taking that into the
record shop? I did. I used to try and get as close as I could to the DJ booth to look at what records they were playing.
Yeah.
And this is something else I also mentioned in my documentary. There's one DJ in particular, Sasha, who used to cover his records with tape. So, you know, if you could get anywhere near the booth,
yeah.
and eventually get a look, it wouldn't say anything.
Yeah.
And that was the one DJ that I wanted to sort of train spot his music more than any other at the time.
Yeah.
And that was in the early 90s. But yeah, I was all over it like that. I was, you know, I kind of threw myself into it, like I said, right from the very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, yeah, it's funny you're talking about covering the labels and stuff like that. We've spoken to Danny Rampling as well, and he was saying that all of like the Shum Italo disco stuff that he used to like crate dig over in Italy, he would cover the label and sometimes write fuck off on it, and people would come over and be like, oh.
Yeah.
So it's a real point. It's a real badge of honor, right? Back in those vinyl days, it was a real badge of honor to have these tracks, and you were the only person that had them.
Yeah. It was kind of what made you stand out from the rest. Mm. If you could get hold of certain records or certain mixes, which were only available on track three on the B side of the import version.
Yeah.
Being an avid record collector, I spent every penny I had on music. I used to have the same, my wardrobe of clothes was very, very small.
Mm.
You know, I looked like a tramp, a scruff, but I had the best record collection.
Yeah.
That's what I spent my money on.
And, you know, buying these records, so you bought some decks next. That was obviously the next logical step. You know, I'm assuming belt drives at first and taught yourself.
Yeah, I had belt drives and I used to try and mix on them, which was practically impossible. And then eventually I kind of convinced my father to buy me some decks, which he did, which he then hated because I was banging it out in my bedroom all the time. Which was the reason why I left home in the end, because he was like, get the fuck out, you know, I can't deal with this anymore. 10 hours a day, boom, 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 in my ceiling, you know? But yeah, and the weird thing was, maybe it was because the belt drive, I don't know, but I could mix instantly.
Yeah.
It wasn't like I ever really struggled with mixing. And I was around a lot of friends at the time, and there was a few of us. One of the guys is a chap called Pete Gooden,
mm-hmm.
who ended up having a good career in Mambo and then became a manager. And there was a few of us that were DJing at the time. And when we'd go out on a weekend, we'd get back to someone's house and they'd be train wrecking everything they played.
Yeah.
And I loved it because like, I could just mix. And they'd be watching me like, how are you doing here? I'm like, I don't know. It just works, man. You didn't match the beat. What do you want me to tell you? You know, just worked.
yeah you were that guy, the oracle, I suppose, at that point, where like, how are you doing this? Yeah. What's going on?
I mean, we used to listen to a lot of DJs like Sasha, whose mixing was impeccable. I remember he used to play two of the same records, one just half a beat behind the other, so he could do this double bumping stuff,
and, yeah,
you know, he was kind of doing tricks with mixing before Pioneer added it to the mixer, you know. But there were some DJs that didn't mix that well, that I like, you know, I really enjoyed Graham Parks, mm-hmm. great DJ. His mixing wasn't always on par.
Mm-hmm.
But you get a Graham Parks tape and I'd be disappointed because it's like every other mix would be coming out of time.
Yeah.
And I'm better than these guys, man. Why can't he mix? Because it was all about mixing then. Like, you wouldn't be able to be a DJ if you couldn't mix. Mm-hmm. You had to be able to mix to succeed.
Yeah. And I mean, so, you know, you were listening to these tapes and, you know, putting your own tapes together and, you know, promoting yourself. What started to get traction for you first locally and then beyond that?
You know what? I never really got much support locally. Birmingham was quite a cheesy house scene.
Mm-hmm.
And that wasn't really my vibe. And I started working in a record store called Global Grooves in 1992.
Yeah.
And I was always buying in these sort of, you know, rare Chicago, Detroit techno records, or a lot of import stuff, Belgian techno. I mean, in those days, techno came from certain countries and that was it pretty much.
Yeah.
If you wanted a sort of US house sound, you'd buy it from the States. If you wanted more deep sort of underground percussive stuff, you'd go west, you know, San Fran, mm-hmm. and those labels that came out of San Fran. If you wanted the more, I don't know, commercially driven tribal, you'd go east where you got Calderon and Vasquez and all those guys. And it was, you know, even in England, it was like that. Down south, it was a tougher sound. Up north, it was more garage.
Yeah.
And I just, like, I used to get paid in vinyl. I never got paid a wage. I'd be able to, you know, take 20 records that week.
Mm-hmm.
But from some contacts I made there, I started putting tapes together and just putting them in the post to make a tape. I'd put some flyers that I'd been on, I'd send it out.
Yeah.
And the first kind of big promoter of the time to come back to me was Charlie Chester.
Yeah.
And because he was doing Club for Life down south, and then I think he was opening Club for Life or something like that in the West Midlands. And what he liked about what I did, which I later found out because we became friends, I sent him a few tapes. I sent him a warm-up, a main set, and a back room.
Yep.
So I was basically saying, I'm a DJ, I'm good at what I do, I love music, and I can fulfill any of these slots.
Yeah.
You can put me in the back room, you can have me open your main room, or you can put me on at the end.
Yeah.
That's what he really liked. And my Balearic tape became his favorite mixtape he ever had. And that's what he told me. You know, he said he used to get tapes and throw them out the car, put it on for 5 minutes in his car, say, oh, shit, and throw it out. And he'd always go back to my Balearic tape. So he first started booking me for the side rooms, for the back rooms, so something a bit more chilled. But then he was like, so-and-so hasn't turned up. You know, Phil Perry was supposed to play. Can you come and play? And I knew what Phil Perry played.
Yeah.
Because actually, Phil Perry was one of my favorite DJs. So I would go and play a very similar kind of music set because I'd often get a Phil Perry tape and then find out what every single record was and go and buy them.
Yeah.
I mean, I was obsessed. I played on my own decks every day.
Yeah.
My record collection grew very quickly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and to have that love of everything, like you say, you could be like the headliner, you could be playing chilled stuff in a like a Balearic selection to begin with, or you know, in the back room. To have that breadth is quite rare, I think, in a way that, you know, it's certainly a lot of DJs when they're starting out almost have to pick a lane purely as a financial sense because they can only afford to play this genre of music. If you were across the board,
I like to consider myself genreless. Mm. For me, it's a corny thing, but it's true. There's two types of music. There's good and bad.
Yeah.
You know, I buy rock records. Mm-hmm. I buy hip hop. You know, there is only two good, you know, there's good and bad. That's it.
Yeah.
There's quality music, which has substance to it and can make you feel great, whether it's an ambient record. I mean, music is a soundtrack to my life. Even till this day, there's always music in my life, whether it's outside sunbathing, I've got ambient music on, whether I'm cooking dinner one time in the kitchen and I've got some, you know, nice soft jazz, whatever. It's a soundtrack. It just lifts. It, for me, life without music is kind of monotone and black and white.
Yeah.
Color, music brings the color to everything.
Absolutely. And I mean, do you find, because you love everything, you know, across, like you say, it's genreless, it's either good or bad. Everything that you do love, there's just so much of it. Do you find that overwhelming in any sense? Is this there's too much to get into? Do you find that sometimes you're just bouncing around too much?
No, not at all. I mean, we'll come to this later, but, you know, now I'm focusing on my new project, Pendulum. My whole point is I spend all week crate digging.
Yeah.
You know, I literally probably put about 30 hours into just one five-hour set. And I'm going through 20 years of music. I'm not just trying to play the latest new track. I'm trying to put together a program of music that just works perfectly.
Yeah.
And sometimes that means playing music from 10 years ago, 5 years ago, 3 years ago, brand new. It's like it's what fits within my realm of what I think is good quality. And sometimes when I start my set, I'm at 119 BPM.
Mm-hmm.
I'll end at 123, but I'm playing almost chill out at the start because I just like the feeling of, if it makes me feel comfortable walking into a room and then you build people, you need that scope of music in you. You need it.
Yeah.
But, you know, having that Balearic tape, like I say, at that point in my life, I just followed what I loved.
Yeah.
That later served me really well when I became a resident at Cafe Mambo.
Yeah, which is my next question. Yeah,
that side of music got me a great job,
mm-hmm.
which led on to much bigger and better things later on. So
yeah, and I mean that time at Cafe Mambo, I mean, how did that gig come about in terms of, was it that specific tape, that one that Jason Bai heard?
Yes, it was literally that. Mm-hmm. Jason is a true unsung hero. Yeah. He's an amazing DJ.
Yeah.
And a great guy, funny, good lad, loyal, you know, it's all the good stuff. Mm-hmm. And he literally said to my friend, this guy's great, you know, tell him to bring his records over. And I went on holiday, and for my whole holiday, I just spent every day at Cafe Mambo playing. And then the owner was like, hey, come on, you stay. And, you know, the rest is history type of thing. But I like it when things happen organically, but nothing happens if you don't do anything.
Yeah.
For those people that want a career in this or want that, you just have to sort of take the end goal out of your mind and just focus on the present, like how much you love it. Because passion, authenticity will always 100% shine through.
Absolutely.
It might not be really quick how you want it, but it will always work.
Yeah.
It's proved it throughout my entire career. And for me, in that case, I was just doing what I loved. Of course, I wanted to earn a living from what I was doing because I wasn't doing anything else.
Yeah.
It wasn't the driving factor. The driving factor was getting to spend my time doing what I loved.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, like you say, that authenticity and being true to yourself and your own passion, your own taste has got you to where you are today. You know, just specifically about Mambo and that era in Ibiza, you know, you were playing what, like an 8-hour set, and then you're playing on the rooftop in Pasha for like however many hours. Like, how long did you do that for?
I don't even know how I did it now, to be honest. But I mean, and as well, I you know, I've never been the kind of DJ that just puts a track on and turns around and talks to someone for 5 minutes. Even with my Mambo sets, which would be 8 hours, I took the responsibility really seriously. Like, it was my job to enhance everybody's time. Like, I was the one person that could really, if somebody turned up on a come down or whatever mood they might be in, I'm going to make them feel better.
Yeah.
And I knew I could do that. I knew that was possible with music. I really believe in the therapy of music. I knew that was going to work. Mm-hmm. So depending on the weather, I mean, if it wasn't a sunny day, I'd play things like Rise on the Storm by The Doors. Mm-hmm. I would change the kind of journey of music that I would play to suit the mood. I enhance the mood.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, I've said this before, it's like performing a soundtrack. Mm-hmm. You know, you want to make it magical for people. And I'm there with records, with vinyl. This wasn't like having a digital 25. I'd have 4 boxes of records. They were my tools, you know. I had to know those records inside out to do that.
I mean, you know, it's a bit, well, I'll say easier these days. It's a bit less heavy on your back and your shoulders. And
I mean, I was glad it went digital for that reason alone.
Absolutely. So, I mean, let's think about in terms of Cream in that era, the time in Ibiza kind of led on to, you know, Darren Hughes taking note of your career, like how good you were, and you're playing a New Year's Eve as a test gig at Cream, is that right? And then that led to the residency that was there. I mean, tell us about, because you were obviously following Paul Oakenfold at that time, and he was, you know, the person who owned the Courtyard in that club.
He was the biggest DJ in the world in that moment.
Yeah.
And I was so nervous at that gig. Mm. I could barely put the name on the record. I mean, it absolutely, I couldn't understand why Darren did that to me.
Yeah.
It felt, as much as it did amazing, it felt cruel. Like, what the fuck?
Yeah.
It was the biggest test he could have ever done.
Yeah.
And in fact, it was his brother-in-law, Mark Broadbent, who was the one that actually told Darren, you've got to go and check out this guy. He's playing drum and bass sets on the roof terrace of Pasha. He's playing Balearic into Deep House at Mambo's. And then I saw him play Amnesia, play a techno set at 4 o'clock in the morning. Who the fuck is this guy? And that's kind of what got the attention.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd given Darren a lot of tapes as well. And yeah, he just put me on. I mean, Paul Oakenfold just smashed the life out of it in his room, the courtyard.
Yeah.
No, I think I was 23 or 24. I was a kid.
Yeah.
But since the age of 15, all I'd done was play music 10 hours a day in my bedroom. So I wasn't, I knew I could do it. And I knew I had the music because I literally practiced on my decks exactly how I was going to play this set. Yeah. And each record in my box that I was going to play after the other was kind of right there. And my box, my record box was always organized. Like the front was deeper, and the further you go back, the tougher the music got.
Yeah.
And that's it. I remember as well, you know, just like everybody was partying. So I kind of got involved as well. And I'm not sure that really helped me in that moment because I just felt completely fried. But it turned out I absolutely smashed it.
Yeah.
And within a week, I was signed as a resident to Cream. So, I don't know, now I'm at the ripe old age of 50. Mm. I do believe, when I look back at my life specifically, that things that happen are meant to be. It's like, it's almost like your path is laid out.
Yeah.
Because you, often even when something negative can happen, it can lead to some of the best moments in your life. I could have easily turned down that gig based on how big it was.
Yeah.
But I rose to the challenge and it paid dividends.
When you look back on that now, you say, you know, you're 50 now and it was like you were like 23 then. Do you think you were ready for it? Do you think that was the right time? Or do you think it could have come sooner, later?
I was ready.
You're ready.
Yeah, it couldn't have come sooner. Darren definitely saw in me that I was committed.
Mm.
Like, I don't know anybody around me that was as obsessive with buying records as I was. And I just did not leave my decks alone.
Yeah.
I was kind of quite nerdy to the point of where I'd just always be on my decks. And like I said, I could always mix. For me, it was always a case of the better you know your music, the better mixes you can do, because yeah. you know exactly when to bring the mix in and how to control it with the EQ. So yeah. I knew I was ready. I mean, I had full confidence in my ability. It was just standing in front of 2,000 people that were essentially there for the guy that's just finished. And yeah. now I've got to keep him there.
Yeah.
That was the only real nerve biter, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, was there, as nerve wracking as it was, you know, once you've kind of got into your groove there in terms of your residency and your time there, did you feel like any kind of competitive spirit with anyone else that was coming in? Did you feel ownership of this venue now that you were the resident?
No, a lot of people kind of didn't understand. Like, in those days, new DJs didn't break through. It was always the same names.
Yeah.
Sasha, Sanchez, you know, it was all those big guys from America, Knuckles, Sanchez, Masters at Work, and it was your English, you know, Dave Seaman, Nick Warren, you know, it was Cole Cox. It was always the same ones.
Yeah.
The smaller guys you'd find at little bars or, you know, in a back room. It's very rare somebody like Darren Hughes would give a newbie
yeah.
an opportunity like this. And that's why a lot of the press at the time picked up on it. I remember one magazine, I don't know if it was Mix Mag or DJ Mag, I can't really remember now, but the title was The New Old Sasha. And then I had another one, which was the UK's Tanaglia. I mean, I always yeah. get like, why won't anyone just say, I'm Steve Lawler? Yeah. You know, I'll put in these tags everywhere else. Because it was just unheard of
yeah.
for someone new to break the circuit.
You're so right.
So a lot of, did have a lot of, especially from Birmingham, my hometown. I remember a lot of DJs at the time, Mark Jarman, John Hollis, all these guys, Patrick Smooth, they were all the big DJs of Birmingham. And none of them gave me a chance. Yeah. None of them ever really, you know, I don't think people helped other people then. It was just like, do your own thing and
yeah.
I'm better than you type of thing. And I do remember Birmingham promoters now all of a sudden really wanting to book me. And I used to remember, I sent you 35 tapes and you never booked me once. And now I'm playing for Cream, you want to book me.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of did carry that in me in the earlier years.
Yeah.
As I grew up, I realized that kind of those kind of feelings are a waste of energy. But, you know, in my earlier days, a young man, I had that.
Yeah.
Birmingham never supported me. Like, the city I came from never supported me as a DJ. Yeah. I had to go out of town to get my work.
So, I mean, that Cream era, that kind of whole super club era, you know, late 90s, early noughties, obviously Darren Hughes split from Cream, set up Home in London's Leicester Square, you know, it was a real sensation at the time that, you know, that was happening. I remember, you know, he was taking Paul Oakenfold with him, you know, he had yourself as resident, Danny Rampling as resident as well. And you know, an iconic venue in the centre of one of the most iconic squares in the country. You know, you quickly got given that Friday night slot and, you know, owned it as Deep South. You know, how did that influence your career and your outlook as a DJ, like having ownership of this night and it becoming more yours in that place in London?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because it was quite a pivotal point in defining my sound.
Mm-hmm.
There was an album I did at the time called Dark Drums.
Yeah.
But what happened was, I was playing at Cream, and I used to prefer playing in, it wasn't the courtyard, what was the side room called?
The Annex. Yeah.
There was an amazing DJ, Paul, who was another resident there.
Oh, Bleasdale?
Paul Bleasdale. Yeah. Amazing DJ.
Yeah.
And he used to be the guy in that room, and I used to love playing that room with him, because I got a chance to play more underground, be a bit more experimental. Whereas if I played in the main room, which is what my job was as the sort of opening DJ, to open up for Sasha, for Paul, for Sanchez, all the guest DJs, you know, I would, within my realms of what I liked, if I was playing before Sasha, I'd play, you know, I'd try and perfectly warm up for him. Mm-hmm. If I was playing before Masters at Work, I would, you know, play dubbier still, but it'd be a bit more on the US sound. So yeah. I always cared about the night. Like, I always care about the experience for people. That's my job.
Yeah.
I do it within my realms of what I like. When I was in the Annex, I could just go right, just go deep into my own, you know, what I love, and just go all over the place musically. And at that time, I was playing more, I was collecting a lot more of the US sound from the West Coast. And if I was getting music from the East Coast, I was always playing the dubs. This is kind of when I was found Tenaglia, mm-hmm, and Junior Vasquez and those guys. And I just loved that. You know, tribal then wasn't even just about music with drums. It was a kind of an attitude. It came from the gay scene predominantly in the US.
Mm-hmm.
And I just loved those rhythms, and I loved the deepness. And if there were vocals, they were kind of stabs rather than full songs, and that's what I preferred.
Yeah.
Then I just kind of, my sound just kind of crafted itself. And there was the Yucatec guys, which was a techno crew. And they had a shop where they would sell predominantly techno, and they were massively into what I was doing. And then I think we were at a party somewhere or something, and someone just said, "I love your dark drums, man." Like, they told me, and I was like, yeah, they are. I guess they are quite dark, you know. And that was the birth of Dark Drums, the album.
Yeah.
And that album did really well for the label, and that's kind of what turned Global Underground onto me. But at the same time, that's when Darren Hughes gave me Deep South.
Mm.
That was another moment where Darren's done it again. You know, first of all, he fucking sticks me on New Year's Eve on after Paul Oakenfold in the courtyard. And now there's this brand new club that's just cost £10 million to build, and you've given me the club on a Friday to curate. And, like, that's a lot of responsibility. And at that point, I'm only about 25.
Yeah.
So, you know, but I always take every opportunity with, you know, with the greatest respect and responsibility, and give it my utmost. I spend every minute of the day working on it.
Mm.
I'm tenacious. If I want to do something, I go for it.
Yeah.
Time I was playing a lot of Angel Morales records, Tenaglia. So I kind of curated this lineup, Seven Fisher, Angel Morales, Tenaglia. Off the back of that, I started my own night in Birmingham called the Midweek Sessions, where I was booking the same DJs, trying to do the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I was really trying to push that sound that hadn't really made it in the UK.
Yeah.
And there was, and I've said this to people, and whether I'm wrong or right, I don't know, but it's how I see it. There was myself, Craig Richards, Terry Francis. Without realizing it, we started the genre tech house. Mm-hmm. It wasn't tech from technology. It was tech as in techno house.
Yeah,
because it had all the sort of instruments that you would usually use in a studio to make techno, but we're making house music.
Yeah.
And Craig was doing his thing at Fabric. I was doing my thing at Deep South. And I think we were the only people in the country playing that really deeper wiggle, were doing their thing. We were the only ones doing it. And I think that's when you can become successful, when you do something and you're at the beginning of it. And we were at the beginning of it. And that really helped the night Deep South. And I called it Deep South because it was deeper music down south. Simple as that, really. But yeah, Darren was amazing. And we had some incredible nights. And that's when Darren got onto Tenaglia. And one thing leads to another. And yeah, it was as successful as it could have been in that venue.
Yeah. And I mean, you've mentioned as well there to Tenaglia, who we've spoken to on this podcast as well. And, you know, the Global Underground and that whole type of kind of era, obviously you're crucial to Global Underground success in terms of the New Breed albums that they featured you on, and then, you know, further on in terms of like Lights Out and things like that, you know, really kind of pushing on this new, like you say, this new sound that you were at the forefront of. It's a fantastically amazing time, a real kind of, you know, exciting time for the scene as well. You know, I want to talk about obviously Space and The End and Harlem Nights, but you know, in terms of your time, you know, I know Space and Harlem Nights were kind of happening like concurrently at the same time. I mean, if we tackle Space kind of first, like Ibiza at that time, you're obviously very familiar with it. How did that gig first come about, and what were you doing on the terrace at that point? Either warming up, were you the headliner? You know, how did you fit into what was going on at the terrace?
I mean, the first year that I played was, I think, 99, if I have it right. Mm. And it was the first year that Darren went into Space, and it was home at Space in the first year.
Yeah.
So it was either 99 or 2000. I think it was 99. And the DJ booth was behind the bar. And up until that point, I mean, I knew Space because I'd been there myself many times. And it was... and everyone knows, obviously, Alex P and Brandon Block, they threw it down on that terrace like no one else did before then. And the truth of it is, they created the terrace, because before that, the terrace was full of tables and chairs, because Space was predominantly a gay club that only opened at 7 a.m. So you couldn't go there before 7 a.m. And it was all about the main room. And it was a big black dome with lightning strikes across, and it was just a huge gay crowd, all the tops off.
Yeah.
Place stunk of poppers and Vicks, you know, it was a proper rave den. And the terrace was where you kind of go and get a breather, because it was like all German DJs playing severely hard techno. The guy that was making all the bookings was a guy called Frisk or something that I can't remember so well, but he was booking all the German techno DJs. He was German. And it wasn't even always that packed, but it was just like the place that you would go to for after hours. Brandon and Alex started doing their, just playing some, you know, typical Brits going in somewhere and drinking the entire bar and just smashing it. And people started standing on the tables and chairs and falling off them. And so the club just thought, fuck this, we've got to move the tables and chairs. And that is, you know, all respect and kudos to them. They created the terrace. Because the owner, Pepe, saw it and thought, oh my God, we're onto something here. So the first year I went in, I was, you know, in their DJ booth, and again, nervous as hell, and realizing that I'm playing somewhere that was one of my favorite clubs in the world. And then eventually Darren said, we're going to move there. And I've got a deal with the club owner. We're going to create a DJ booth on the main floor. We're going to do it here. I actually went in with Darren in the winter, helped him design. Well, say design, I gave him all my input on the booth, and, you know, I mean, how much of that was used or whatever, it's irrelevant really, but it was like, I really felt like a piece of the furniture there. I was really valued.
Yeah.
And so Darren just made me a resident when he started We Love. And at first, my job was to kind of play the, as it goes from day to night, you know, like, at, you know, at 7 or 8 o'clock around that time. But Darren always felt as though the headline DJs would let him down. You know, Darren also came from being on that terrace, listening to Brandon and Alex smash the fuck out of it. Mm-hmm. So he knew how this terrace could be and he wanted that energy.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, some of the DJs would come and do their thing and he wasn't getting what he wanted. And so he started putting me on last. I'd play the last 2 hours. And again, young, very new to this, very excited, but just took it in my stride, was very serious about it.
Yeah.
And it turned into something magical, and the Space Terrace residency was the point my career went from being, I had press at that point. Mm-hmm. I was on front covers, you know, things were going really well. But then I became a big time headliner, like overnight.
Yeah.
And that was a point in my life which I kind of struggled with a little bit.
Yeah.
Because it happened so quickly. Before that, everything was just developing nicely, like really evolving. Remember, I've been DJing myself in my room since I was 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And so everything, you know, it felt like it was 4 years before anything happened.
Yeah.
And then it was another 3 years as it was happening gently. And all of a sudden, within the space of 12 months, I'm being flown around on private jet. I'm turning up and there's 10,000 people there to see me.
Yeah.
That was very difficult for me. I wasn't ready for that at that point.
Yeah.
You know, yes, having 2,000 people on the Space Terrace when there's about six DJs playing is one thing. Turning up to 10,000 people and they're all there for you, that's a different type of anxiety.
Yeah. In terms of that pressure as well, did you feel like that pressure changed your performance in terms of being true to yourself? Did you feel like you had to perform for them rather than for yourself?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, you've always got to perform for the audience, but within your artistic boundary, like, mm-hmm. And what I felt, there was great. I was playing some amazing records, but I felt the pressure to play more. I'm still playing 4 hours with vinyl.
Yeah.
Wasn't like I was rocking up, like, you know, we'll come to this, but like now a DJ turns up for an hour with a USB. It's a different business to me. That is, that's just not, I don't value that as DJing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I like to build my set and create an experience, but in a gig that size, there's different pressures. You've kind of got to get to banging it quicker.
Yeah.
And you've got to have bigger moments. And I don't know, like I've always, especially going through my career now, looking back, I consider myself a club DJ. I do like playing big shows, don't get me wrong, but I hate festivals, by the way. I hate them. I'll explain why later. But at this moment, I felt the pressure and, you know, I turned more to drugs, I guess, at that point in my life. I was partying more.
Mm-hmm.
I document this very well. I'm not ashamed to talk about it. It's part of, you know, everything we feel is already in our brain and our neurological system. These are just chemical substances that are releasing, you know, certain things that are making us feel this way.
Yeah.
And it made me cope with what was going on at the time, or it helped me cope.
The pressure to perform and everything that's going on, it's all too much. It's all very quick, like you say, and being able to have to deal with that, you know, you are going to lean on things that will kind of help you medicate yourself through that, whether that's, you know, if it's drugs, if it's alcohol, if it's what, you know, whatever it is. Did you feel like there was kind of some kind of spiral at any point? What did you feel like you had to kind of make a conscious decision to check yourself?
Well, I needed it as well, because I had things like I had a residency at Release in San Francisco on a Friday, which would be an 11-hour flight from the UK.
Yeah.
I'd play for 8 hours. I'd then sleep for 3 hours. I'd get a 6-hour flight from the West Coast to the East Coast to play my residency at Twilo in New York. I'd play for 10 hours, and then I'd fly back to the UK on the Sunday, you know, and then next week I'd be away again on Thursday. And it was, you know, just the sheer volume and, you know, you kind of need to medicate yourself at that point.
Yeah.
Because you can't just sleep when you want to, and you can't just wake up when you want to, and you've got to be on your, like, in a higher mood. You can't. Yeah. You've got to control your moods according to your schedule.
Yeah.
Nature and real life doesn't do that. So, I mean, that's just the way that I went for a time being. And yes, it did spiral, because I found myself, I mean, I laugh at it now, but my agent, Tara Morgan, for Accession at the time, mm-hmm. I used to have bookings on a Saturday after Harlem Nights. And Harlem Nights was such a regular crowd there every month. And all my friends would be like 20 or 30, my crew would come. And we would party. We'd all go back to someone's house after, and we would party hard right until 5 o'clock the next day. And then it'd be like time for me to go to the airport and get a flight. And I'd either buy 20 tickets and take all my friends with me, or just not turn up, because I couldn't bear the thought of being on my own at that point.
Yeah.
And there were times that I'd just like buy about 8 or 9 tickets for my mates to go, right, we're all flying to, I don't know, to Romania for the night. Yeah. Or I would miss gigs. And eventually my agent just stopped putting gigs on that Saturday, because she knew it was a good chance they weren't going to make them. So I didn't need that kind of help around me at the time, because I was just rock and roll. It was in that moment. And also I was brought up on the Doors. You know, I used to look at Jim Morrison as a hero. So I was kind of like living my dream, you know. It was like, it was a great time.
Yeah, absolutely. Like you say, rock and roll, you know, private jets, all your friends around you. And definitely that era, like when you see footage from that era, especially in space and stuff like that, a lot of people who are into the scene now who never lived through that look at that as kind of, you know, a pinnacle era. Especially with the things around phones and things like that. I mean, we'll probably get into a bit more on the technology side as we continue. I mean, just thinking about that King of the Space Terrace moniker that was like bestowed upon you. How did that kind of sit with you generally? And what are kind of any key standout moments, memories from that time?
I mean, honestly, you know, there was never really one moment that would, you know, define it. It was that whole time was incredible. Playing on the Space Terrace was the best gigs in my life. There was nothing else like it. I mean, as far as an outdoor party was concerned, you know, at that time it was just a net that covered the dance floor so people didn't get sunburned. And you'd see the planes coming over, and it's just... You see, when you go back to that era, it was new. Before then, it was like if you went to a club, it was a discotheque playing the chart music, or there'd be these raves, illegal raves out in the country. Mm. Now what we used to get in illegal raves were in clubs. So even that was new. And I don't know, it's just all about, you know, the drug of the moment was ecstasy. And MDMA, and that just makes the entire room want to hug and love each other and smile and dance. And the kind of frequency that you have just in the air, the vibe is electric. Mm. It was impossible not to have a good time. And it's those moments that kind of made it just exploded. Electronic music exploded around the world. And ecstasy was a big part of that. Mm-hmm. Whereas the years progressed, you know, it changed. A lot of things changed. But it made that era, you know, the early 2000s was probably the time in my life which was both the hardest in terms of how I was dealing with things internally. But that was some of the best gigs. And, I mean, that was my pinnacle. That was when I was at the top. And actually, people that know me, I mean, I always kept my long-time friends around me because it kept me grounded.
Yeah.
And I needed that. And people that really know me will know that I'm not comfortable being really famous. I'm not comfortable having all the attention spotlight on me. It's not, that's why I had to medicate. It's not natural for me. I'm not comfortable in that environment.
You've come through the other side, you know what I mean? And you've still maintained that integrity in terms of your sound and your taste.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
And you have already mentioned actually your monthly nights at the end at Harlem Nights.
They were amazing.
I must admit, me and my brother used to go there all the time. So, you know, it was that was kind of my era, my Steve Lawler era, if you will. And it's kind of an interesting point in that the two other people that I run House Culture with, they're a bit younger than me. And their Steve Lawler era is Sankey's in Ibiza. My Steve Lawler era is Harlem Nights. And I'm sure we're going to talk about Pendulum as well. Obviously, we will. I'm sure there'll be a whole other generation that will have a new kind of Steve Lawler era to talk about. And it's that general kind of evolution throughout your career. You've always been pushing on. But in terms of Harlem Nights and that era, you're smiling, you're saying it was amazing. Tell us about a typical night. What were you trying to do there, and what was that club The End like for you?
When I first went to see the club, people were saying to me, it's really hard to play, there's a pillar right in front of you, and actually I didn't view it that way. When I first played, Leo booked me to play The End on someone else's night. And I loved the fact that the DJ booth was kind of like you had the crowd all around you. Like it was the most intimate it could be. Mm-hmm. Now, remember Space Terrace, you're on this platform. A lot of other shows, the DJs were being sort of hailed up there and you was always a certain distance away from the crowd. Well, not in The End. You were like with a set of decks in the middle of an audience.
Yeah.
And that really created a really special vibe. I mean, and it was a low ceiling, it was dark. And again, I got to do my own thing. And it's always about me doing things in the fashion that I want to do them and playing the music in the way that I want to play it. And for me to be able to do that and it work, I want a residency. It's like, I don't, like I've just said, I'm not comfortable with fame and all those things. I've always preferred being a resident DJ than I have being a headliner. You know, to me, there's more about being a DJ than just rocking up somewhere and playing for 90 minutes and taking the glory.
Yeah.
I want people to enjoy the night and I want the club to be full and I want to get paid well. Anyone that tells you different's lying. But the most important thing to me is that I get to create and do what I want to do. That is first and foremost. And so having a residency, you get to do that. You get to carve out your own thing. And those days was like the lights out era. You know, I kind of went really deep into the sound that I'd carved and that I was really pushing. And I could curate the night musically.
Yeah.
You know, again, like providing a soundtrack as I did at Cafe Mambo.
Yeah.
You know, it's always the same story. It's what I'm doing now with Pendulum. It's just, it's basically who I am. And having the ability to do that and a regular crowd as well brings its own magic.
Yeah.
When people come back again and again, they buzz big time because they're like, they can't wait. They've been waiting all month for this night.
Mm-hmm.
And you need 100 of them in a room, just 100 of them in a room. And that energy spreads.
Yeah.
It does. It really is a thing.
Yeah,
and so, you know, that's where the magic comes from. Yeah. It comes from the audience, not me. I'm doing my job and doing it with a lot of thought and passion. But how people are reacting is what brings the magic.
Yeah, totally. And that residency as well, and that regular crowd gives you the opportunity to break records that you're passionate about, to, you know, create anthems of the night that resonate with the crowd, being like, he's playing this one again, you know, I heard this last month or whatever, and just, you know, really breaking those tunes. And that's something only a resident can do, right?
Yeah, I mean, a good one for this is Stardust, Music Sounds Better With You. I had an acetate of that, and it was given to me on the terrace in Ibiza at Space. So I don't know how many acetates were cut, maybe five. And I was one of the first DJs to have that pivotal record. And I broke it in Ibiza. I broke it on the terrace. You know, I feel like I'm certainly not the reason, but I play a part in that record's success, because that became an anthem in Ibiza and then went on to become the Miami Music Conference tune of that year and stuff like that. So there are, you do get to have moments and records like that with a residency, especially towards the end of the night when you close out. And you close out with something like, I used to close out with an original of Urban Hymns, The Verve. Totally unexpected. It's not a house record. But it would be like people hugging and like, it's just incredible moments.
Yeah.
You know, and people knew I'd do that. I would finish with something like that. You get to do that in a residency.
Cool. I mean, yeah, I love those nights. So, you know, I'm glad I had my time at the end.
Glad you were there.
I've actually got...
You already know what they were.
I know, I already got it.
The energy in that room is incredible.
I have got a Bomb Dog signed Steve Lawler record as well.
Yeah.
Which
I've
is like...
I've played that again recently.
Did you? Always one that I remember from there. I want to talk about briefly, I mean, it's a similar kind of theme as well, in terms of like your time at Sankey's in Ibiza, you know, the difference between that place and the Space Terrace, obviously. You know, Sankey's sadly is no more on the island, but, you know, it was a new thing at that time, and your kind of whole Viva Warriors creation at this place, you know, and this is the theme that I think you've really covered anyway, is that, you know, it's the opportunity for you to own this space and really deliver your sound and your vision. What, if anything, have you got more to say about Sankey's in that little era that you had there?
Well, I'll tell you how it came about, right? So I'd done my residency for We Love, and then Darren kind of stepped down from We Love, and Mark Broadbent and Sarah were kind of taking over more and more with the booking side of things. And Mark Broadbent has an incredible taste in music, but he's also quite left field in his approach and very daring. You know, he's got huge balls as a promoter, and he will start to book FX Twin, and like he started to book sort of real left field bookings for We Love.
Yeah.
And I just felt as though the change there just didn't fit where I was musically. So I left We Love and then went to another night that somebody else was running called Care Kuma. So I was now just another DJ on the lineup for somebody else's night.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't take long before that didn't sit well with me. You know, I was just couldn't do my, you know, I was given a 90-minute set in the middle of the night. And I'm like, what am I supposed to do? I can't DJ that way. I mean, but I know I'm not going to be great. I'm just another DJ. And that sounds really narcissistic. But it's not. It's because the most important thing to me is the music.
Mm-hmm.
It always has been. The most important thing to me is delivering the best I can. And I know I can't do my best in that environment.
Yeah.
So, and I was my agent at the time was William Morris, which is the biggest booking agency in the world. And I told William Morris, I'm leaving Care Kuma and I'm going to start my own night at Sankey's, which used to be a club called Kiss. And my agent at the time, Steve Hogan, David Levy, who was the main guy there, were like, that's going to be the end of your career. That would be the biggest fail. We advise you not to do it.
Yeah.
If anyone knows me, if you tell me not to do something, that's exactly what I'm going to do at that point. So that didn't help at all. But I already had it in my mind that I wanted to do something that DC10 was the most underground club in the world at that point. Definitely the most underground club in Ibiza And one of me, for me, one of the clubs that will go down in history, DC10 is the church for many people. Mm-hmm. But that's the only thing that existed in Ibiza that was like that. Everything else was, I remember people dancing on the speakers at Space and getting chucked out of the club.
Yeah,
I didn't like that. Didn't sit well with me. I remember, you know, just the island becoming more and more VIP, more and more this type of built around tables and all these type of scenarios. And I, as I usually do in my career, kind of, and I don't know why, because it's not always served me well, but I always want to do the opposite. I always kind of want to go the other way. I'm the opposite to a follower. I'm like, if everyone, that's why I've never been a camp. I've never been in somebody else's camp. Mm. Like out there, you've got DJs and they're all a part of Hot Creations Paradise, or they're a part of, you know, they're all a part of camps. I've never been like that.
Yeah.
Because I'm like the naughty child. I always want to go the opposite way. And that's exactly what I did. And Dave Vincent, who was a complete nutter, he said to me, just come and play the club and you'll see what I mean. I went and played the club at the closing of one season and I knew straight away, I can do something here. And the following year, and these are great stories, I was in that club painting it black because it was white. And I said to Dave, I won't play here if it's a white club. It's got to be black. And he was like, fuck's sake, Steve. Fucking Steve, like. And I also said, and also I don't want any bouncers inside the club. So rather than saying, I want this much money, I want this, I want this, I want this, I want champagne, I was like, I didn't ask for any of that shit. I just said, I don't want any security inside the club. Keep the bouncers outside. Mm-hmm. I don't want anyone getting chucked out of the club for having too much fun. You know, this is going to have to be the underground haven.
Yeah.
Because at that point, even at DC10, it was getting a bit on top for everybody. Mm-hmm. So I kind of wanted to essentially create a club night for me and my pals where we could go and let loose a little bit and have some fun. So all my requests and requirements were like, I want the club painted black. I don't want any bouncers inside. And I remember being there and we painted the floor black because it was this terracotta sort of tiled floor. And we painted it black. And after the first event we did, everybody's fucking shoes and trainers were covered in black paint because it got so sweaty in there. It all came off on everyone's shoes. It was such a guerrilla way of doing things.
Yeah.
The club was a shithole, right? There was some graffiti in the toilets and Dave was saying, I want to do that. And I was like, I played a really big part in that venue, like a really big part. I said to Dave, no, do not try and polish a turd. Because if you try and make this look all posh like Passion, all these other clubs, you're now in competition and you're not going to do well. You know, you can't compete with these guys. So, and Warriors was about graffiti.
Yeah.
It was built off the back of a movie about, you know, a gang going around New York. And when they were going to a territory, they'd spray their name Warriors. Mm. So I said to Dave, just fill the toilets with graffiti, you know, like just, he thought I was nuts. Dave was nuts. So thank God Dave was an incredible promoter. And he trusted me. And at that point, he'd been open for 2 years and it was make or break for them at this point. If their night didn't work this summer, they were out.
Yeah.
So Dave kind of did exactly everything that I wanted because I was only 2 years off the back of We Love Residency. So I was still at quite a high point in my career.
Yeah.
And yeah, the rest is history of Warriors. It became an incredible night on the island against all the odds. Mm-hmm. Everybody were like, everybody thought it was the end for me.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite the opposite.
Yeah.
It just made my career pump all over again. And all of a sudden on the front cover magazines again, it all went up there again. You know, it kind of like had its moment. Mm. And Warriors at its peak moment were the best nights in Ibiza. And it was the cheapest ticket. It was the cheapest club. And we were giving people the best night in it. It was the party.
Yeah.
It was the party.
Yeah. I mean, what do you, and down to that success, I think has got to be like, yes, it might have been cheap, but, you know, it had a real energy to it. It had a vibe to it. It was completely different from other venues, you know, like you say, it was a shithole. It had graffiti everywhere, you know, and that was part of its charm. It was the complete point of difference from everything else that was going on or is going on in the island. Do you think Ibiza is missing some of that spirit right now, or do you see it is what it is? And
I mean, look, the world has changed and modified, and more the industry became a much bigger industry. The electronic sector became the music industry. All the big corporates got involved, from your Live Nation, all these type of people. It became a big business. And with that brought change. And no bigger change than the beginning of Ushuaia. You know, they came in, they ruffled a lot of feathers, they upset a lot of people on the island. I remember on the main road of Ibiza, there was protests all down the road. Ushuaia has to go, you know? But you can't beat change. You have to simply embrace it and try and shape it so you can embrace the change, but again, do it in your fashion. For me, at the time, the reason why Warriors worked is because it was unique for the island. There was nothing else really like it. The year that we came out of Ibiza was the year that Solid Grooves was born in San Keys. So like, I mean, not in San Keys, in Privilege. We came out on the Sundays, they started on the Sundays. Solid Grooves crowd were Warriors.
Yeah, yeah.
Warriors wasn't happening anymore because I'd done a deal with High, so everybody went over there. And that was the beginning of Solid Grooves. Mm. And when we came back the year after, I realized very quickly, it's done. And that's something else I also do. I don't want to, like I keep evolving. You want to call it evolving. To me, I'm not evolving. I'm just, it has to feel right inside. It has to have, like, I know when it's done.
Yeah.
And rather than trying to slug a dead cat and force something, forcing that square block into a round hole, is call it a day.
Yeah.
You know, back from it. And that's what I did with Warriors. And even to this day, people are like, oh, bring back Warriors. I'm like, fucking no chance. Because it would never recreate that magic. I mean, when we finished Warriors, we were still packed. Mm. We were absolutely rammed. That club was rammed. I mean, we were putting 2,500 people in that club. We didn't do billboards. We graffitied around the island, which also pissed a lot of people off because no one was doing it at that point. Mm-hmm. Now they are, of course. And I can happily put my hand up and say we were the first ones to do it because we were. But the reality of it is you just know I've done really well for my job financially, and I'm very, very grateful and fortunate. But it's never been the controlling factor. So even though it was doing really well, when I stopped doing that, I gave up a lot of income to stop doing that. But it just felt right. I knew when I'd be playing and the energy wasn't there and it wasn't the same, I knew it was over.
Yeah.
I'd rather finish it than let it die slowly.
So Pendulum, your new project, what is it about and how are you approaching it and why is it different from what you've done before?
So basically, when we came out of the pandemic, there was a million gigs to do. And my agent, I think I had like 12 or 15 gigs in 1 month. And I did that tour. And my first phone call after that tour was to my agent and said, don't ever do that to me again. I'm not DJing like that anymore.
Yeah,
I can't do it. I just can't do it. I'd lost my tour manager. He died, sadly. And he'd been my tour manager for 25 years. He was my best friend.
Oh, sorry to hear that.
That changed the way I viewed pretty much everything. In the space of a couple of years, I lost my mother, I lost my best friend, I lost my house. I was going through a very, very, very challenging time.
Yeah.
And when you go through a moment like that, you know, I was just solely focused on my wife and my children. Mm-hmm. Like anything for me came last.
Yeah.
It kind of out of that, I didn't want to be away from my family all the time. I didn't want to tour like that. I felt I had really bad anxiety, which I was trying to control with pharmaceutical drugs. And it just, I just saw it. I was like, I can't do this. I just cannot tour like this anymore. And so I kind of came off the road a little bit. And myself and my family, we just said, fuck this. We sold everything and got a one-way ticket to Mexico to change our life.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know what was next. We didn't know what we were doing. And I went to a really low place, but out of that, you have to find, and this has happened to me before in my life, you have to find a real strength in those moments. And I mean, that's when you're tested.
Yeah.
Because at that point, you can feel like giving up quite easily when everything's going wrong. And it didn't come in threes, it was coming in tens. And you've got to keep getting back up when you don't even want to get out of bed in the morning. And you've got to do that for other people, namely my children. And you can't show weakness. You can't show how bad things are in front of your kids.
Yeah.
So I had to really pull myself together. Didn't have a clue what I was doing, but DJing wasn't working for me.
Mm-hmm.
Being quite honest, the music I was getting, most of it was shit.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, oh, no, it's come. The time has come. I don't love my job anymore. I don't love DJing.
Yeah.
And if anyone knows me, if I don't love something, I'm not going to do it. And that was the moment I thought, I'm going to retire.
Yeah.
And I spoke to a few people about it and they were like, you can't retire. You just can't. I was like, I don't love it. And I was doing some gigs because I needed to earn some money, but I just did not enjoy it.
Yeah.
I was more ridden with anxiety than anything else. And then there came a moment where I kind of had a bit of a break from touring. And in life in general, we're finding what we wanted to do. We eventually found ourselves in Miami, found an incredible school for our children. And in that school, we found a beautiful community of people. And I became quite spiritual,
mm-hmm.
and learned a lot that I needed to learn.
Yeah.
And even at the age of 50, you can still change things. You can still do it. And I learned a lot. And from that, and the reason why I call the night pendulum, by the way, is because a pendulum that swings. And a lot of the things that I was learning were based on, number one, trust the journey. Mm-hmm. Something my wife used to keep telling me all the time, trust the journey. You know, don't try and control the future. Be present,
yeah.
And the future will come.
Yeah.
And I learned all these really beautiful, amazing things. And a friend of mine gave me a book, The Four Sacred Secrets, which is basically about living your life either in a suffering state or a beautiful state. That book changed everything for me,
mm-hmm.
like literally changed the way I thought. And that's when I started Pendulum. And what I wanted to do was just DJ once a month in my own night. And what had happened, and this literally, before this, Tech House had gone to such an awful place. It was 128, 130 BPM. It was literally all the same shit.
Mm-hmm.
The same sample packs, same bass lines, same drum kits. There's only so many commercial pop vocals you can use in a breakdown. I mean, it was like, I hadn't fell out of love with DJing or music. I was looking in the wrong place.
Yeah, yeah.
I fell a victim to just being in that area of producers. And I felt like I couldn't compete in that area because it wasn't natural for me.
Mm.
I mean, there were DJs like Detlef, for example, who to me was one of the best DJs and producers on the planet. He went down that minimal tech route. For me now, it's not the same world.
Yeah.
I need more depth in music. I need music to touch me emotionally. And then I started coming across people like Who Made Who. And I found this world of music that I was like in love with.
Yeah.
So between the music and the fact that I love performing and playing music, I wanted to start something just about that. And that was the birth of Pendulum,
mm-hmm.
which we started in Miami. Then I had the opportunity to do it in Tulum. And it was a moment in Tulum where this all kind of came about, so it felt right to do it there. And since then, we're starting a New York residency,
mm-hmm.
and I'll be doing some regular shows in Toronto. And the way that I want to DJ, and like everything counts in my career, I'm just doing it. I don't really care what anybody else wants me to do or expects me to do. You know, being the big guest DJ every week, playing 12 times a month, being, you know, the biggest DJ on a festival, it's just ego.
Yeah.
It's all ego driven. I don't have an ego anymore. I literally couldn't give a fuck for that stuff. I don't, you know, a lot of people are asked, where's Steve Lawler gone? What's happened? You know, like, I don't care. I'm doing residencies. I'm playing 3 or 4 times a month, which means I'm getting to do what I love without destroying the quality of my life. I'm around my family still a lot. I'm at home a lot. I've started a management company called Talent First Management, where I can actually put a lot of my knowledge and a lot of my 35 years of information and contacts and help others. I can do what I love and do it exactly how I want to do it.
Yeah.
I don't answer to anybody else or what anybody else wants me to do. Even my agent. My agent, bless him, like, I turn down way more gigs than I do because I just don't, you know, it's got to be, if somebody wants me now to travel to the other side of the world, it's got to be really, really worth my while. Or I'm like, I'm good, thanks.
Yeah.
I've got my pendulum shows. That's all I want to do. Because for me, being a DJ and playing music, I want to do the best I can and be the best I can. And that's the environment I can do it. And so here I am again with another residency. Same pattern that's gone on for 30 years.
Absolutely. And, you know, now you're at this point where it's like it's that maturity in your own mind of that trust in the journey, like your wife has said, and the trust in yourself, knowing that actually I want to play. If I'm going to continue playing, I want to still play stuff that I love. You're not just going to play, you know, something that you're expected to play. And if you think it's crap, call it out as crap, you know, which you have done.
I mean, look, I want to say that the at the moment, I don't recognize the music industry for the most part. I don't like DJs now that it's all about 1 hour, 90 minute sets, festival lineups. Like promoters are quite clearly trying to sell tickets. So they're going to put 1 million DJs on. It's not about quality anymore. It's just about quantity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't exist in that world. I don't recognize it. I don't recognize what DJing's become. For me, DJing is, you know, being the curator of music for a night and giving people an experience. It's all about the atmosphere and the experience, delivering what everybody knows they're getting more for their money. They're getting a really great night out. And if you go to a night and there's 6 DJs playing in 6 hours, you might really like this guy, but three hours later, that you don't like what he's playing. Your night's all over the place.
Yeah.
That's not how to do it. So I'm not saying that what the younger generation now is doing is better or worse. To me, it's just not what I'm in it for. It's not why I did this in the first place. It's not what excites me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just doing my own path. And the reason why Pendulum has grown now is because it's authentic. I'm just doing what I love. And it's worked really, really well. We're packing these nights out. They're rammed, literally rammed. But the audience is more mature.
Mm-hmm.
You don't get phones out all night like this. It's just not built around that. You know, it's kind of like a really nice, you know, it's just an amazing atmosphere of people just getting down, partying. And that's what Warriors was.
Mm-hmm.
That's what Harlem Nights was. It's what We Love was.
Mm-hmm.
It's what Deep South was. It's kind of the same thing. I'm just obviously just being me. Mm-hmm. I'm just doing what I love. And I think if you do what you love, you do it well.
Perfect. And, you know, what's the next stage for Pendulum then? Obviously, you know, you mentioned New York, Tulum, Toronto, you know, are you going to take it outside of the Americas? Are you going to take it across the world? What's next?
I literally had this conversation last week. My agent was like, right, Mexico City, one Pendulum. And I literally started getting anxious. I literally, I'm like, hang on a minute. I'm not doing this so my diary grows.
Yeah.
I don't want to play more than 4 times a month. I don't want to. A lot of people around me don't fully understand it because I'm turning down money.
Yeah.
And most people won't do that. But honestly, I've got to a point in my life where my quality of life isn't about money. It's about having a quality of life.
Yeah.
And for me, Pendulum, playing once a week, and I play for 5 hours, 6 hours, I'm good. That's me done. I got to fulfill my you know, my passion. I got to do what I wanted to do. Now I can enjoy the rest of my week. And it comes again next week. The idea of going back on the road and doing that two or three times a week makes me want to throw up. There's no fucking way I'm going back to that. There's no way. Yeah. No one could pay me any amount of money to go back to that. Because I'm not happy there.
Yeah.
And my family's happier like this. So, you know, it's just, I'm just doing me. I'm doing me. I'm doing it my way. I'm doing it the way I want to do it. And that's how it'll be now until I do eventually hang up the USBs.
Well, hopefully that won't be anytime soon. I mean, you know, you I can see the way you're talking about this. You seem reinvigorated by this project, and you know,
I love it.
Yeah,
it's there's no way I'm giving this up anytime soon because it's not exhausting me. It's not like killing me, and it's not making me unhappy. And they're the things that come like I've had in my life. I talk about this in my documentary. There was a point when I came out of the terrace, and that when it really blew up and got really big. And I didn't like it. I just didn't like that much pressure. So I started saying no to big shows, which used to drive my agent, Tara Morgan, up the wall, because I'd be turning down these huge paying gigs. And then instead I'd go and play a really small underground club for a fraction of the money.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of doing the same again. It's just like, I can't be any other way than true to myself. So, you know, and obviously, it's not like I do this for free. I do well, but I don't need to do better. I'm not driven by that desire to do better and better and be at the best and be at the top, because the music industry can be quite a toxic environment to live in.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to be better than the next guy. Everybody's climbing and they will climb over you. And I've had this. I've had people that I've helped that have pretty much shat on me. You know, like the industry is ruthless.
Mm-hmm.
I'm no longer in that industry. I'm doing my own thing. I've got no one to compete against. I've got nowhere to climb. And it's a beautiful place to be.
Awesome. You're in the Steve Lawler industry.
Yeah.
Obviously, we've got the five tracks that you gave me are Who Made Who, Closer, The And Me and Black Coffee, The Rapture, which, my God, is such an incredible tune. Kind of Music, Bang Bang, which is really, really new, Lunar Plane, Tusk, and Hrach and Armin Miren, Reconnect. I probably mangled that last one, but you listen to all of these in their entirety and together as a whole, you can really hear the kind of sound that, you know, you're developing and you're bringing to bear. And all of them aren't, you know, some are about 5-6 years old as well. So, like you say, it's about working in the whole rather than playing the really upfront new stuff.
I'm looking for, when I'm choosing music, I'm looking for a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not just hearing a song. Like I'm looking for a feeling, because that's part of the journey of music. When I play, it's about feeling music. It's not just about hearing it. And rather than saying anything about each individual track, I'll just tell you the reason why I've given you that selection is because, you know, there's people always want to tag me to a genre. You know, why are you not playing tech house anymore? Or, you know, are you playing progressive again? Or whatever it might be that I've had recently.
Yeah.
And I don't follow genre. Like when I was tagged tech house, let's say the Warriors days, if you listen to what I played then, I was playing 123, 124 BPM. And the producers that were making tech house at that moment were making it sexier and groovier and dubbier.
Mm-hmm.
Tech house, or those particular producers like Detlef, for example, are not making that anymore. They're making 130 BPM minimal tech, which I just cannot get. I just don't like it.
Yeah.
So my style as a DJ has always been the same. Like the fact that I've had residencies throughout my entire career has always been the same. You are who you are, and there's no point trying to hide away from that. But producers change where they're making music, and I'm just following the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's tech house producers that are making that sound, then you can call me tech house. If it's Afro House producers that are making that sound, then call me Afro House. Call me progressive. Call me what you like. I'm really deep house, whatever. Because I'm, as far as the genres that are on Beatport, I'm playing deep house, progressive house, Afro House, and tech house. And house. That's what I'm playing.
Yeah.
But you hear it in one set and it flows perfectly.
Absolutely.
Because that's what I do, is to craft something of your own out of what other people are making. That is the real job of a DJ.
That's a brilliant place to end. We do have one final question, which is always, you know, obviously we've talked about your career and your place in house music history. This is obviously the House Culture podcast, and we've talked a lot about, you know, crowds and scenes and, you know, the behind the scenes and the crowds in front of you. You know, the term kind of house culture as a movement, you know, what does it mean to you when I say that?
Yeah, house was a movement. You either were the type of person that was into house music or you wasn't. That was the real way of defining. But like I say, all of those extra elements that were there basically made electronic music and house music become the main commercial form of music that we know today. But within that, there's so many layers, so many places to go. I just don't know where any of our generation would be without it, quite frankly.
Perfect. Cool. That's it. It's all over.
We're done.
Thank you so much.
Great conversation. And it was nice that you knew about all this stuff. You knew about every step, which is always nice to hear.
Yeah, this is a real passion project, this podcast.
Therein lies the success of it, right? It's your passion.
Exactly, yeah. And it's about putting that good stuff out in the universe and, you know, trusting that journey, like you say.
Yeah.
Cool.
Perfect. All right, nice one.
House Culture.
Such kind words from Steve there at the end, and it was great that we caught him in such an open and reflective mood. It sounds like he's in a really good place, doesn't it? We wish him well with his Talent First management company and his new Pendulum project, where you can catch Steve as resident in New York, Miami and Tulum. It's not to be missed if you're in the area. As you heard in our chat, Steve sidestepped the themes of the House Culture Perfect playlist in preference of sharing music with us that is special to him right now. You can hear what all of these tunes are by searching for House Culture Perfect playlist on Spotify or by clicking the links in the episode description of whichever platform you're listening on. Speaking of platforms, please drop us a note of support in the comments section of YouTube or Spotify, leave us a review on Apple, or even drop us a message on Instagram. We thrive on your feedback and we will always aim to respond personally. Plus, you might just hear your name in an upcoming episode. With that in mind, I'd like to say a huge hi to old school East Coast raver Skylar Funk, who, on our chat with US house legend Joski, dropped us a gem of a comment on YouTube mentioning her picture of Joski and onions that she has in her raver memorabilia box. Skylar, we would love to see that. Reach out and share those memories with us. That's it for now, but please don't forget those basics. Follow this podcast, subscribe to our YouTube, and please come and visit us at House Culture Net on Instagram. You can also stay in the loop by following the hashtag True House Culture. And for direct contact, hit me up on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. It's great to be back, so thanks for listening. Rave safe, and see you next time.
House Culture.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig.
Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.